Hi, my name is Allison Mead, and welcome to What She Said, an episode of the LA FPI podcast series. The Los Angeles Female Playwrights Initiative is dedicated to encouraging and promoting the work of female playwrights. And today I'm going to be speaking with Jamie Brantley, whose play Bliss, or Emily Post is Dead, is currently playing at the Atwater Village Theater. Her plays include Technicolor Life, SOE, M Theory, Soldadera, Sisters 3, Through the Eye of a Needle, Medusa's Song, O, A Rhapsody in Divorce, and Bliss, or Emily Post is Dead, which was named to the Kilroy's List in 2014. Her work has been produced and developed at New Dramatists, Wordbridge, The Lark, New York Theater Workshop, Great Clean Theater Conference, Launchpad, The Antaeus Company, Chalk Rep, The Road, among other venues. And she's also won the John Gassner Memorial Playwriting Award, Holland New Voices Award, and Aurora Theater Company's GAP Prize. She's been a finalist for the 2016 Penn Literary Award for Drama, Playwright Center Core Writer Fellowship, Princess Grace Award, O'Neill National Playwrights Conference, and the Disney ABC TV Fellowship. And she was also nominated for the Susan Smith Blackburn Award. So welcome, Jamie.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, Bliss begins with a very, very familiar setting for a lot of women, which is a tea party. And I wanted to begin with that germ inside your central idea and see how Emily Post and the idea of manner seem like the right jumping off place for your story to begin.
Sure, but I do have to go back to the beginning of how the story started. Well, actually, the inspiration for Bliss. Can I do that?
Sure.
Before I get to the manners part? Okay, great.
Oh, yeah.
So in the late 50s, early 60s, my aunt Barbara, we grew up in a working class situation in Jersey, and she was a very young housewife, and her sisters were as well. And so she told me the story about how she and her younger sisters used to share this one vacuum, so they would, you know, clean their apartment, and inside this vacuum they would transport a bottle of their amphetamines that were prescribed by the one doctor. So they clean their apartment, then put the bottle of pills in the vacuum cleaner, go to the next sister's house, clean the apartment, take a pill, put the bottle of pills, and go to the next sister's apartment, and so on and so forth. And I was pretty shocked. No one ever told me, and I was like, so you do realize that I'm going to be using this for something? And she said, why do you think I told you? So at that point, yeah, it was pretty amazing. I was like, oh, so, and at that point, several years ago, I wanted to do some sort of adaptation mashup, specifically with the Greeks. And so when my aunt told me that story, It somehow sort of clicked me into Medea, Clytemnestra, Antigone being in this suburban area of New Jersey, and I wanted to explore an event of something that was on the precipice. So with civil rights movement and the second wave feminism, 1960s a really kind of great time period, and then that brought me to Emily Post. And so Emily Post and Etiquette, the Blue Book of Social Usage, basically the glue that put it all together to sort of sharpen my focus, and I was able to go, oh, right. So don't get me wrong. I believe in manners. I think that they are essential to live a civilized life. But there are certain parts in the book where I feel like she encroaches on what people should do with their lives versus just setting up how a tea party is supposed to go, or, you know, correct place settings at a formal dinner. And so that, to me, sort of brought it all together. And what better way to bring the misfits of this community, the Clytemnestra, Medea, and the Antigone together, other than a tea party. So that's how that all came together. I know it was a lengthy answer, but that's the only way that I can answer this, because I didn't start with Emily Post. You know what I mean? Like, Emily Post came later, where I was like, oh my goodness, this is this just sharpened everything for me, and then I just sort of took off and wrote the play.
Well, you sort of alluded to it, but we soon find out that this is no ordinary tea party. So we have characters like Medea, Antigone, Cassandra seeking to break the bond of the patriarchy. So I wondered if you could talk about how each of these female characters begin to inform your narrative as the play takes shape.
Sure. So all of the female characters in my play, Antigone, Clytemnestra, Medea, Cassandra, are all beholden to Apollo's, basically, he writes out their fate. You know, they need to fulfill their fate according to his needs. And so that was the other thing, in addition to Emily Post, was realizing that all of these women, not just Cassandra, who I think is the most more known story of, she's been cursed by Apollo by visions that no one would ever believe for all eternity. And then if you know Agamemnon, you know that Clytemnestra is directly connected to Cassandra. But in addition to those other stories, Medea and Antigone are also connected to Apollo. So when I was writing this, you know, like, this is something that I, you know, and I'm also an educator. I teach playwriting at Lesley University's Low Residency MFA program. And what I often tell my students is don't write towards a theme, because then your play is going to feel forced. So the idea of patriarchy wasn't at the forefront of my brain. It was, oh, this male god is controlling their lives.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to write from that specific character situation versus a theme, right? So the only thing that I knew what I wanted to happen was to have the women in some way, shape, or form recognize some sort of cycle and try to break out of it in some way. But then there are certain characters in the play that choose not to do that, choose to do something else. But I wanted to show the struggle of, you know, with your life being, your life doesn't have to be predetermined. But yes, it's a very scary thing to say no to that and move forward into the unknown, that's where I was coming from. And what's interesting about the play is that, you know, as society, as we have, as an American society, move forward into a different kind of era from Obama,
right,
the play just became something else, and I had nothing to do with it. It was very interesting, and I was like, oh, this is interesting. Huh. And then, but I also wanted to have a conversation, too, about, because in many ways, the character of Apollo has a predetermined life too. So I wanted to have I'm hoping now with this last production of Bliss, because it had two other productions earlier, one at Moxie Theater earlier in the year in San Diego, and then a production in the summer at Promethean Theater in Chicago. And even this year itself, things got even more interesting, if you will, with the current situation of men and women. And so this last production, I really had a great opportunity to go back and revise and make the play stronger in terms of me wanting to have a conversation about certain things versus pointing my finger at men, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. So why is Cassandra the right one to break this mold?
Oh, just specifically, that's a story element that is directly connected to the myth, in that she was at one of the temples, it was probably Athena's temple, and Apollo saw her and thought she was beautiful and wanted her, and she said no. And so in turn, he cursed her with visions that no one would ever believe. And that goes back to Troy, and it's actually called the Cassandra syndrome now. Like when people, you know, like when somebody says, you know, this thing is going to happen and no one believes them. And so the way that I took, you know, with my, I wanted to take that story back and give her a chance to break the curse. So I just basically reversed it and was like, okay, well, somebody has to believe her and somebody has to kiss her, because in the myth, after he curses her, he seals it with a kiss and a spitting in her mouth, which is, I guess, for me, I'm like, oh, that's a bit much, but it's the Greeks, what are you going to do, right? So I just want... So
not known for their subtlety.
No, not at all. Not at all. So for me, I'm like, well, what is the most logical way to break a curse? Well, you just do it and you just do it in reverse in a way. And so that is why the onus is on Cassandra to do this and to convince these women that they have other choices that they can make in this modern society of 1960, versus, you know, killing your husband and killing your children and killing yourself. Does she succeed or not? No, you got to go and see the play. But my message is, yeah, hopefully, you know, like Cassandra realizes that she's going to take her own advice and move forward into the scary unknown of, you know, what does life look like outside of something that's been supposedly predetermined. And for me, the ultimate message of the play, you know, it's definitely female centric, that's for sure, because my MO as a playwright is to write female narratives for the stage. But it's a story for everyone, which is, you know, you can take control and change your fate. You know, you don't have to fall into a certain story pattern just because you think that's the way it's supposed to be. You have the power to, you know, create change and do something different. I think for, you know, speaking in my own life, when I've had to do things that I didn't think I would ever have to do to change my current situation, to change my fate, was the scariest thing, because it's like, well, what does that look like? I thought my life was going to be like this and it's not. So now I have to make a different choice and make other different choices in order to change that. And what does that look like? So it's sort of like, you know, embracing your fear and moving forward versus allowing the fear to keep you trapped into this certain cycle.
And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the development of the piece once you had finished it.
Well, this play has been one of the more interesting plays of its development life. So I always tell my students and other playwrights that, you know, every play has its own journey. You know what I mean? Like, just because you've written all kinds of plays doesn't mean that, oh, the next play is going to get produced right away. No, that doesn't happen. So every play has its own journey. And for me specifically with this play, you know, I started writing this play like 6 years ago. It's a long time. And then once I got onto the Kilroy's list, the play got so many readings, right? So many readings. But when Trump was voted into office, I got 3 productions. So I just think that it's an interesting crossing of how the play was affecting people and how the change in an administration was also affecting people, and how that sort of converged in such a way where the play seemed to have an interesting, I don't know if I want to use the word relevance, but the it affected people, I think, on a different level.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense. So
absolutely.
I'm not complaining about that, but it was certainly an interesting, it was an interesting journey to see how the play sort of developed and affected people over time, and how the time affected the way the people digested the play.
Okay. And so basically the development of the play was the Killer Eyes list. And a lot of readings that sprang from it, yeah?
Yes, but it first started at the Great Plains Theater Conference, where I was the play, what was I called? I was like one of the winning playwrights of the theater conference. And it was well received, and I was very grateful because it was the first public reading of this play, and I was like, oh, this is really interesting. And then it had a few more readings after that, but you're absolutely right in that the Kilroy's list, which I had no idea, I didn't even know what that was because it was the first list that came out, it really helped the play get a larger spotlight. So I'm very grateful for the Kilroy's list. Very grateful.
Well, finally, I always like to ask people what they're working on next and what we can look forward to from you.
Sure. I'd love to tell you all about that. So I've been a very lucky Los Angeles playwright this year in that I had a production of Through the Eye of a Needle at the Road earlier this year, and now Bliss with Moving Arts. And my final L.A. production is Sisters 3, at Versus Theater, produced by Inkwell Theater. And that's opening December 14th, and it's running till January 20th. And that's my weird, but I love it, kind of super modern, absurd update of the Bronte sisters. So I'm very lucky in that, you know, I'm having this final production of the year. So I'm looking forward to that.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today and break a leg.
Thank you so much.
Well, Bliss, or Emily Post Is Dead, plays at the Atwater Village Theater until December 10th. It's directed by Darren Anthony and features Anne Noble, Jacqueline Missai, Becca Gordon, Jasmine St. Clair, and Andrew Carter. For information about tickets, please go to www.movingarts.org. And for more information about LAFPI's resources, activities, and opportunities, please visit www.lafpi.com.